everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Achieve more success in arousing, organizing, and mobilizing the people of Canada of various nationalities and ethnicities against monopoly capitalism and for democracy and socialism.
That was exiled leader of the International League of People Struggles, Jose Marie Sison, or JOMA. Basics own Steve Da Silva caught up with the exiled leader in the Netherlands for an exclusive interview. We will be the first to broadcast this interview, which is a Basics exclusive. But first, we speak about Donald Marshall Jr. He was a Mi'kmaq activist who recently died from complications of a lung transplant. Marshall became famous for his wrongful conviction in which he served 11 years on false murder charges. The scandal sparked a royal commission which condemned the systemic racism of the Nova Scotian court system. We'll play a clip of a man who wrote Justice Denied, the story of Donald Marshall. All this and more on Basics when we return.
Siècle, l'homme invisible dès l'Ixon existe. Le préjudice demeure, persiste et puis signe. La résistance n'est plus dès qu'on s'y résigne. Et l'amnésie collective s'installe tranquille. La haine dans ce monde est basée sur des faits vécus. L'histoire se répète chaque fois qu'on dit jamais plus. Les cœurs s'assèchent comme un désert où il n'a jamais plu. Où les vautours rapacent qui étaient restés à l'affût. Il y a ceux qui ne connaîtront jamais l'aube de la fin. Pour d'autres, la fin du monde arrive chaque matin.
Donald Marshall Jr., the 50-year-old Mi'kmaq activist, died of lung complications on August 6, 2009. Marshall became famous for his 11 years served in a federal prison under false pretenses, a sentence which began in 1971. A botched robbery attempt by Marshall and an accomplice, Sandy Seal, ended with the man they were robbing, Rob Ebersery, fatally stabbed Seal. Ebersery claimed he told the police that he, in fact, had struck the fatal blow, but police were determined to lock up Marshall. Witnesses continued to come forward to Marshall's defense during his imprisonment, and when the truth could no longer be suppressed, Marshall was released. Marshall, however, didn't quietly fade away. He returned to the spotlight in one of the landmark Supreme Court cases in Canadian history. The Crown versus Marshall was a case that in the end pissed everyone off, but was seen in some respects as a massive victory for Native rights. The court held in the first decision that the famous Donald Marshall's catching and selling of eels was valid under a 1760 and 1761 treaty between the Aboriginals and the colonial government, and that any licensing system or regulatory prohibitions would infringe on that treaty right. In the second decision, the court elaborated the extension of Aboriginal treaty rights, stating that they're still subject to Canadian law. So in the end, like I said, it pissed everyone off. So here's a clip of Andrew Harris, who was his biographer, and who and eventually was adapted into a movie.
A Native rights activist who was wrongfully convicted of murder and spent 11 years in a federal penitentiary for the crime that he did not commit. My colleague here at CFRA, Michael Harris, wrote the definitive work on the Donald Marshall story. It's called Justice Denied, The Law Versus Donald Marshall. It was that book largely that led to a royal commission that investigated the Marshall case, which I would say surely must still rank among the greatest injustices in Canadian legal history. And Michael Harris has been kind enough to join us today on the Afternoon Edition. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Rob.
What are you thinking today, Michael? I heard some of your program this afternoon that you dedicated to Junior. Yep. But what's going through your mind today?
Well, I guess a lot of mixed emotions. One of the things, of course, is that I got to know Junior Marshall very well over the years. And to die at 55, after having been through what he's been through, and there's been a lot of battles, not just the main battle that we all know so much about, but it seemed to me unjust in a kind of a cosmic way that his life would be cut off at 55. As you know, he had a baby late in life. His wife gave him a son, and he was pretty excited about that, but didn't get a chance to see that child grow up. And I guess with a double lung transplant, you're beating the odds if you live a couple of years, and he beat the odds by quite a bit, but still, 55 is pretty young. That's sad. And the other thing that's sad, Rob, that not many people know, is that in many important ways, Junior felt that the injustice continued. And it was 8 years after his acquittal that the system finally took the blame for what happened. As you recall, the appeal court, in saying he was not guilty in 1983, also blamed him for what happened to him. I've never seen anything like that myself. So
I couldn't believe that. You know, it brought back a flood of memories for me today, and all the names surrounding that case, not just Donald Marshall Jr., but Sandy Seal, who's another victim of that case, of course.
Yes.
Roy Ebsery, Ann Derrick.
McIntyre.
Ann Derrick is a name that came up. I learned today she's a judge now in Nova Scotia. I didn't know she was one of Donald Marshall's lawyers for a very long time, human rights lawyer in Nova Scotia. But you know what is what people may forget is that Jean Chrétien was the one who ordered the appeal division of the Nova Scotia Supreme Court to rehear this case after they let Donald Marshall out of prison, Dorchester Prison.
Yes.
And the appeal court blamed him.
That's exactly
blamed
right.
him and said that any miscarriage of justice was more apparent than real. Can you imagine?
Well, that is what makes the case, which is marked with these kinds of extraordinary turns of events, so depressing to look at, because the appeal court was facing a man that they had put into prison, the system had put into prison for 11 years for crime he didn't commit, and then they had the audacity at the end of the day, in acquitting him of that crime, of saying the reason he went to prison was he didn't tell the authorities what he was really doing that night. So if you can imagine reverse onus, it is the classic example, and it was...
When I'm in town, I keep it locked every time to CHRY 105.5 FM. You see what I'm saying? CHRY at the moment, every time. They play the music, I'll survive. Yeah, man, keep it locked.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
This is Basics Free Community Newsletter and Radio Basics, the people's news and the people's radio. I'm Steve De Silva, and we're here in Utrecht, Netherlands, with Jose Maria Sison, one of the founders of the revolutionary struggle in the Philippines, namely the Communist Party of Philippines and the New People's Army. Jose Maria Sison, or Joma, as many people around the world know him and refer to him with endearment, is currently the chief political consultant to the negotiating panel of the National Democratic Front of the Philippines, an alliance of the Communist Party and various revolutionary mass organizations in the Philippines struggling for national democratic revolution. JOMA is also the chairperson of the International League of People Struggles, an anti-imperialist and democratic alliance of more than 300 people's organizations from over 30 countries across the world. We're going to be talking to JOMA today about the struggle for democracy and socialism against imperialist globalization, which is the title of the most recent volume of his collected writings. Joma, thank you for agreeing to meet with Basics today.
Thank you, too, for having me.
Joma, 2008-2009 has been witness to one of the most grave crises in the history of capitalism. And this, in addition to the intensification of a capitalist world food crisis, military aggression, and occupation, and a scale of environmental destruction approaching catastrophic proportions. Will the big capitalist governments of the world be able to resolve these contradictions, as the media and the politicians keep telling us? What are the economic roots of these crises?
The current crisis comes after a series of worsening and deepening over the decades. The monopoly capitalists thought before that they could overcome the phenomenon of stagflation in the 1970s by adopting the policy which they have called neoliberal globalization. This means simply blaming the working class and social spending by government for the phenomenon of stagflation. And the monopoly bourgeoisie has carried out a fierce class struggle against the working class during the last 3 years. They have been trying to cut down the wage level and cut back on social spending for education, health, housing, and so on. Now, despite all these attempts to maximize profit by reducing the incomes of the working people, the crisis has repeatedly emerged. Pressing down of the wages is precisely the cause of the crisis of overproduction. Production is expanded, especially with the adoption of higher technology, and even the outsourcing has made more goods available at cheaper prices by using the cheap labor of other countries. But if the policy is to reduce the incomes of the working people and degrade the economies of so many countries in the world, then actually there is a constriction of the market. But the imperialists have been able to conceal this reduction of the market by using finance capitalism. Debt financing is used. Within the United States, there's debt financing for the households, while workers are thrown out of regular jobs. They are compelled to take on part-time jobs, and the income has become stagnant. But then credit cards and so on, down to the use of the mortgages at teaser rates at first. These have been used to keep up the high level of consumption in the U.S. for some time, but it cannot be debt financing forever. The producer corporations, all types of corporations, both those producing things and the financial corporations, have generated money for themselves by using, you know, bonds and all sorts of devices. In the financial world, all kinds of derivatives have been generated. And the state has also engaged in excessive borrowing. So you have this borrowing to cover up the basic problems. You know, it's a continuous process of trying to lick the problem of overproduction by pressing down the real wages, and then on top of this, to conceal the continuing constriction of the market, finance capitalism goes into debt financing. But you know, debts cannot be forever, because capitalism is not Santa Claus. At one time, the interest rates can be reduced to entice people to borrow, but since capitalism is not Santa Claus, a time comes for raising the interest rates and demanding payments and taking over properties and reducing the consumption of the people. So now that's a problem in the U.S. Unemployment and a fall in consumption, and this affects the entire world capitalist system with less credit available to all people and to all countries, and unemployment is rising, orders for certain things produced in the countries where production is outsourced, these have come down, and so there's a big problem for the entire capitalist system.
Can the capitalists resolve this crisis and the contradictions that they entails?
It's difficult or impossible for the capitalist system just to reduce the problem to a certain manageable level. This thing is going to worsen and deepen because policymakers of the imperialist countries stick to neoliberalism. So what they do is to keep on pouring money after bad money. So it's the old method of giving bailouts to the very financial corporations, the banks and other kinds of financial corporations that have caused the problem. And then there's nothing like what was done during the time of Roosevelt under the New Deal, generating jobs with the use of the work projects agency. The public money passes through the offices that directly hire people for certain public works. But now the money is being funneled to corporations, to favored corporations, and the corporations use the money to balance their cover the losses, and whenever possible to make profits, to give higher salaries and bonuses to corporate officials. So, and all these things are done at the expense of generating employment. The corporations don't create the jobs, and it is seen where the bailouts have been the biggest. You see the continuing rise of unemployment and contraction of the market.
So if capitalist imperialism can't recover from such a crisis, or at least not in any peaceful manner or anything acceptable to the people, then the task of recovery seems to rest on the democratic, anti-imperialist and revolutionary peoples of the world. What must be done by people who are struggling around the world? How can they fight back, and how can we build a different society that doesn't entail these contradictions?
Well, the people have to organize themselves, but to enable the people to organize, there must be systematic campaigns of information and education to let people know what are the causes of the crisis. And then by knowing the roots of the crisis, then they can think of the solutions. Real problems are solved through knowledge of the internal factors in a problem. The solution is to be found within the real problem. And with an increased level of understanding of the crisis as a problem, then people get organized. Naturally, we think first of the working class, since it's the most progressive force as productive and political terms. It is the agency for change up to socialism. So the highest the priority should be given to organizing the working class. But you see, in In the industrial capitalist countries, you have the urban petty bourgeois. The petty bourgeoisie is also big in number. And so they have to be organized. And the bourgeoisie can be seen in various sectors. Just as, you know, among the workers, you can also sectoralize them in terms of what industrial lines they are in. No? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I think those are the two big social forces,
the working class
and the petty bourgeoisie. At the mass level, you know, there's even a mix-up of ideas, no? The monopoly bourgeoisie makes it a point to, you know, deceive people by presenting monopoly capitalism with petty bourgeois dressing, no? Monopoly capitalism is described as free enterprise. That's a big lie, no? Or free market, no? But anyway, with class struggle being furiously carried out by the monopoly bourgeoisie, but in so many subtle ways, you know, even the working class, the minds of people in the working class are adversely affected by the campaigns of deception carried out by monopoly bourgeoisie. Anyway, when the workers and the petty bourgeois are organized, then ready to fight and understand, and as they fight, they struggle, they come to understand more what is the problem and what is to be done in order to solve the problem through revolutionary struggle.
And what about in the majority of the world, semi-colonized, neo-colonized? What are the revolutionary class forces there, and where do we see those class forces making a real difference in different parts of the world?
In many countries, the working class is minority, and so there has to be consideration of the peasantry. In countries like the Philippines, semi-feudal, you have the peasantry as the majority class. Then there are also the intermediate social strata, petty bourgeois in character. In many countries, the workers, peasants, and petty bourgeois comprise the three basic forces. In the Philippines, for instance, these comprise the potential and real basic revolutionary forces against the big comprador agents of imperialism and the feudal lords, the landlords. And you have variations between the highly industrialized countries and, you know, countries with a heavy vestiges of feudalism. Well, to look at the entire world, the industrial proletariat would be a minority still, no? The majority are still peasants. If you take the world, you know, people who belong to the industrial capitalists are amount only 20%, and that includes everyone, no? 80% of the countries in the world and the peoples in the world are still underdeveloped.
And you're listening to CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
And where in the world do we see that these three basic forces of the semi-feudal countries, the proletariat, the peasantry, and the petty bourgeois, are actually making revolutionary change, in addition to the Philippines, of course, which is...
Well, in addition to the Philippines, you have India, Colombia, Peru. In Nepal, there is a diversion towards parliamentary struggle, the Nepali Maoists are trying to still capitalize on what they gained through protracted people's war, and they hope to be able to make a people's uprising someday. But of course, they try to move towards the direction of people's uprising by testing the limits of the parliamentary struggle and trying to discredit their opponents within that process.
Anyway, you might say that the revolutionary potential as a result of the current crisis is not yet well realized. There is a lot to go. You know, the conditions are so favorable. It's a good thing that this crisis will run for probably more than 10 years before there's any temporary reduction of the severity. You know, in the absence of revolutionary struggles, the imperialists can manage to reduce the level of gravity. The crisis remains grave and unsolved, but there are temporary. When consumption is so exhausted and the crisis has brought down, you know, there can be rises, no? There can be spikes. Well, even under the present conditions, there are spikes along the general way of descent, no? It goes this way. Mm-hmm. But it can be all the way. The degradation of most economies of the world can go on and on. And the point will come when people will rise up. As a matter of fact, the director of national intelligence of the U.S., Admiral Dennis Blair, has already expressed fears that there might be a going back to the violence of the 1920s and 1930s. You know, there is a price to be paid for the betrayal of socialism by the revisionists. So because of that betrayal, it seems as if capitalism is forever and socialism is hopeless. But you know, there is a heavy price to be paid for that. With the imperialists in total control of the world, you're going to have this kind of economic crisis, mm-hmm. fascism, mm-hmm. and wars of aggression. And the world has become so much tighter with one more imperialist power added to G8.
China?
Russia first. Russia. From social imperialism to regular imperialism. Yeah. And then China is also there, aiming to become a major imperialist power.
And what we've seen,
but it comes out, actually, if you look closely at China, it's still a poor country like the Philippines. It's a huge country, and and you have a few sweatshops on the eastern coast supplying these consumer products to the U.S. and other imperialist countries. But, you know, if you look at the per capita GDP, China is still, very much within the bracket. It's way below the 100th country. But then it's like, while the times seem to be good in this global partnership between the U.S. and China, China can play with the money it accumulates from exports. Mm-hmm. But then that money is subject to capital flight. It is also subject to devaluation, you know, because their dollar holdings is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. The dollar holdings are vulnerable to, you know, to sinking, to the sinking of the value. And then, of course, China can make bad investments. So you have these problems for China.
And in history, we see that the other threat, a major threat that looms very large currently, is maybe the threat of inter-imperialist war or world war. And historically, the First World War and the Second World War, we see that those wars came about at a time when the imperialists wanted to redivide mm-hmm. the world, redivide mm-hmm. the colonies amongst themselves. And with China and Russia asserting themselves more forcefully in the mm-hmm. sphere of international politics and imperialist politics.
Yes, that's right. With the world capitalist system having become tighter in terms of the increase of imperialist powers and in terms of their intense desire to redivide the world. in order to get the sources of cheap labor and raw materials, markets, spheres of investments, and spheres of influence. The danger of war comes from that. First, because of the so powerful weapons that are in the hands of the imperialists, they will try to struggle, they will try to wage wars through proxies. Maybe that will be the first appearance, but you know, the most effective counter to the possibility of war with the use of nuclear weapons would be, you know, the rise of revolutionary civil wars. A nuclear superpower becomes paralyzed when the people themselves, mass and prevent the imperialists from using the nuclear weapons. But anyway, before you can have any coming to the brink nuclear war among the imperialist powers, we'll see more and more from year to year the more intensified inter-imperialist struggle.
Let's talk about resistance and organizing now, which is what is necessary in this time of crisis. Joelma, you're the chairperson of the International League of People Struggles. What is this organization and how can people and other mass organizations get involved?
Well, first of all, people should be aware of the concerns of the ILPS. It has 18 concerns. I can mention some of them.
Sure.
The concerns include national and social liberation for all peoples of the world, economic development for the underdeveloped countries, human rights, the cause of peace against imperialist war, promotion of trade union rights, agrarian reform, women's rights of children, and so on. There is no major issue that is not covered by ILPS. And you must include, of course, the problem of ecological destruction by the imperialist powers. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's included. And with all these concerns, all entities, be they organizations of whatever size and still unorganized people, can come forward. Those already in mass organizations should have the mass organizations joining the ILPS as member organizations, and the people not yet organized can join the existing mass organizations, or they form organizations that dedicate themselves to being member organizations of the ILPS.
Mm-hmm. So how do mass organizations go about getting involved in ILPS?
The application for membership can be filed directly to the International Coordinating Committee through its General Secretariat. If in a country there is already a national chapter of the ILPS, then the mass organizations can also file their application with such national chapters.
Why is this level of international coordination important right now for people's organizations and mass organizations across the world?
It is important because ILPS was conceived of in expectation of the worsening of the crisis of the world capitalist system. Long ago, even before 1999, where, you know, the formation was announced while the battle in Seattle was going on, no? It was already seen that the world capitalist system would go into a grave crisis. Mm-hmm. And there is a need for a rallying point for the people of the world.
And while the anti-globalization movement came and it went with its spontaneous uprisings and hopping from summit to summit, the ILPS has survived and it's grown and it's getting much larger, has it not?
Yes, that's true. It's grown from the level of 240 organizations in 2001 at the founding it has grown to more than 350 organizations.
To conclude then, Joma, do you have any final thoughts for the peoples struggling in Canada right now in this time of crisis?
I would wish the people of Canada to... And I should
also say this includes the indigenous peoples who are really at the forefront right now and struggling and fighting for their rights.
Yes. I would wish the people of Canada, of various nationalities, and of course all the indigenous peoples, to fight against imperialist globalization. They can play a very important role because right they are in the country, right beside the big monster, the United States of America, and of course the ruling class of Canada and that of the United States of America are closely interlinked. They collaborate to oppress and exploit the people both in Canada and elsewhere in the world. So I would wish that organizations that are progressive work hard and try to achieve more success in arousing, organizing, and mobilizing the people of Canada of various nationalities and ethnicities against monopoly capitalism and for democracy and socialism.
Well, Joma, thank you very much for meeting with Basics and Radio Basics.
Thank you, too.
This is Radio Basics and Basics Free Community Newsletter signing off in Utrecht, Netherlands. All power to the people.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at chry.fm. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics, we are back. So you were just listening to Basics member Steve, who is out in Europe, and he met up with Jose Marie Cisson, or Joma, and did an exclusive interview. So I hope everyone enjoyed it. It was an insightful interview. If you didn't catch it, hit up www.radioforall.net, and in the search, in the little search part, type in Radio Basics, and you can find all of our shows there. And, you know, if you want to download this one, it'll be posted probably by tomorrow morning after I edit it up. So, also, I just had a visitor in the studio. My man Uzman, Uzman, and he informed me that he's, you know, a Toronto artist, and he heard the interview, and he's like, "Well, they're talking about bailouts. I have a song, called Bailout on my MySpace." He's like, "I wonder if you'd play it," and you know, I told him that I would because you know, at Basics, we support Toronto artists, local artists, you know, local issues. So here is the radio premiere, the CHRY radio premiere of Bailout by Uzman. Check it out.
The recession, first lesson, I'ma tell you what up. The tax man, I got your tax cash all caught up. And as the world turns, man, the more cash burns, poverty may become the more the average concern. The rich become poor and the poor get poorer more. Then more and more get locked out the job door. Who to stop? The days from childhood to adult would result to the financial insult. Read my lips, man, if you don't hear my speech. Don't stack your baskets no higher than you can reach. It causes the rest to suffer the sufferation. Back of town's no longer in circulation. Take what you can, man, and take what you can get. Cause when it's all said and done, we may face a big debt. Before you know it, they tax more and they blow it. Bail out, poor bail out, and expect us to owe it. Bail me out! Five to life, possibly provide for children and wife. Right before my eyes, I see my credit turn to debit. Bailouts get bailouts, and I just don't get it. Time to put a fence on tax man expense. Tax man save my dollars and start making sense. Tax man don't cut slack, the tax back they cut back. Tell tax man you want nothing more cut but tax. Sorry for all y'all having trouble with your mortgage. I can't afford mine, so I can't make up the shortage. I look around and I see that I'm not alone. Some got no pay stubs and some got no home. You made a good hustle, but think about your grandson. What you put in the will might be time.
taxable rental. I find it hard to smile cause it ain't even funny. Sitting here wondering when you're gonna bail my money. Bail me out.
Yes, CHRY 105.5. You heard it here. That was Bailout by Usman. You know, Usman just came into the studio. I guess he was putting up posters and stuff and, you know, gave me his card. He said, check out this track. It is on point with the interview. So, you know, it's a Toronto artist. It's sick song, sick lyrics, you know, on point. Usman, keep it up, man. You're doing a good thing. So, continuing on with the show. I got an interview here. Not an interview, sort of a short documentary clip about something that went down in international waters. You know, you hear a lot about Somali pirates, and what are we going to do about, you know, those Africans on the coast, you know, terrorizing ships that go through. And there's it's little known fact, well, maybe to, you know, people in Canada and North America, that Israel and the Israeli army, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, have been guilty of massive maritime crimes. And this documents it. Basically what it is there was a contingent that went on a boat to deliver aid to Gaza after the, you know, the strike that went down in January, right before the Obama election, or the inauguration, sorry, and in international waters, Israeli ship took them down, which is a crime in international maritime laws. And this interview will elaborate. So here it is. Check it out.
One here. On June 30th, the Israeli Navy hijacked our small boat, the Spirit of Humanity, 19 miles off the coast of Gaza. They kidnapped 21 crew members and passengers, including a former U.S. Congresswoman and a Nobel laureate. Then they forced them into port in Israel. Was this an act of piracy? And did Israel break international maritime law? The answer is yes. An act of piracy is defined by the law of nations, includes illegal acts of violence or detention committed on the high seas or outside the jurisdiction of any state. Israel's hijacking of our boat fits the first part of that definition. The Spirit's unarmed passengers traveled on the high seas, vulnerable, uncertain if they would live or die, when the Israeli Navy surrounded them and took them prisoner. But this act of piracy pales in comparison to Israel's ongoing hijacking of Palestinian fishing boats.
Would you tell us about the day you were attacked and injured?
12th of March 2007, we light our lights that we need for fishing, and the Navy was know and see us in the boat as a fisherman working all.
How far were you from shore?
Beside shore of Rafah.
How do you know this? How do you know? Do you have a GPS?
GPS. Yes, you have GPS already. Suddenly, after we spent the night, it was at 5:30 in the morning, we heard the bomb and shouting. Suddenly, the shooting was about 30 minutes continuously. Then I heard the big sound and I felt I lost my hand.
No one seems to have the will to stop Israel. It acts with impunity, shooting Palestinian fishermen, kidnapping them, forcing them into Israeli waters, and stealing their boats.
CHRY 105.5. That was a short documentary clip. You can find it on YouTube. I found it on the Monthly Review website. Just documenting, you know, the plight of Palestinian fishermen off the coast and their... being terrorized by, you know, the Israeli army. So I highly recommend checking it out. It became kind of popular because Cynthia McKinney, former U.S. woman, and she ran for U.S. president, not in the last election, but the one before. She was actually on the ship, and you know, so it kind of made way in the mainstream press. So, you know, that's it for the show. On Saturday, Basics, in conjunction with CHRY, we're having our second annual Justice for Owie basketball tournament at Carlton Park, located at DuPont and Symington, you know, in Carlton Park. So you should come check it out. We got food, music, tons of basketball. You can get a team in if you want. You know, contact Basics. You can find us at basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com, and you know, hopefully we can find a slot for your team. The deadline's Wednesday, and with that, that's our show. So you know, we got Vince with the blues coming up next, so I'm gonna take it with a blues track. Here we go. See you next week.